All right, we are live here. We are here today with James Jammaster Jay Butcher. Don't let me say that again. That was horrible. If you don't know who he is, you've been living under a rock. First and foremost, a couple years back, there was a book that came out, which I cannot show you because I lent it to my son, never to be seen again. So that was book one, Dead Man's Hand. Absolutely fell in love with that book. Also got my hands on Long Past Dues. Threw me off because I'm looking at it backwards and like I'm reading backwards here. And then, of course, dropping tomorrow, Cold Iron Task is coming out. Managed to get my hands on that one. A shout out to Berkeley Publicity and Penguin Random House for getting me a copy early so I can act like I know what I'm talking about. Normally, I ask you to introduce yourself, but I think I've covered all the books that you've started. So I will ask you the question that I ask every author.
Sure.
What is your supervillain origin story?
Well, I mean, mine's a little bit more obvious than most because my dad's also an author, as some people might be aware. And I kind of just grew up around books. I remember I didn't really take to them very easily. To get me to read and learn to read as a kid, my parents would bribe me. They'd pay me $5 for every Pokemon novel I read. My dad also taught me to play EverQuest, and he would, read to me all the combat logs and all the chat. And then one day he's like, well, I'm not going to read anymore. And he walked out of the room and just left me to play on my own. And so it was sink or swim. So in order to continue playing, I had to learn to read. So I had to kind of get leveraged into reading. But once I did, I kind of fell in love with it. I read all through elementary school, middle school, high school. I was basically just always had a book in my hand. I started realizing that I wanted to be a writer about the time that I started getting set to go to college. And I figured it'd take me maybe a good year or two to hit the New York Times bestsellers. And I was, 18, 19. Turns out it took a little bit longer to than I anticipated for sure. I enjoyed the process. It took me a few years. The first book I published was the seventh book that I wrote. And the other six will never see the light of day. I've got my very first, not like the five of them are just in the ether, probably just gone. But I've got my very first novel. I was so proud of it. I printed it and bound it and everything. And I was working at Office Depot at the time. So I got a discount. And it's somewhere in the closet over there. And it will also remain there. But anytime my head gets too big, I can just go and take a look at it and get my ego put in check real quick.
Understood. Yeah. I've heard a lot of authors say that there's a few books that were written before the one that got in print and nobody will ever see them.
Yeah, exactly.
But you did have a couple of, I mean, Evercrack, I totally remember playing that. Oh, yeah. I'm probably closer to your dad's age than yours, but definitely remember pulling that. And you probably missed out, but when I was a kid, Pizza Hut used to be able to get like the little pizza for reading sometimes. You could just get personal pizza. They just give it to you if you turned in something that you read so many books. So do miss that sometimes. I probably don't need the pizza, but I do miss it. All right.
Nice to have that incentive.
Exactly. Not that I needed it. I did love reading. Real quick, for those who are the aspiring authors in the room who always wonder, what does a writer's day look like? What does a day in the life of James J. Butcher look like?
Well, now that I'm a couple books in, I'm a full-time writer. My schedule's open up pretty considerably, which has been very nice. I have a pretty much a night owl schedule. I don't operate during many of the human hours. I go to bed at 3 a.m, wake up at about 11 or noon, and then kind of repeat the cycle from there. But really, as long as I get my writing in for the day, which takes 2 to 4 hours, and then I get my gym run in for the day, which takes a couple hours, that's about 6 hours of my day. And as long as I've done those two things, I feel unburdened to do everything else I want to do. I can do anything I want guilt-free. Which is a nice feeling, being able to control your schedule like that, just set those little benchmarks, get them done, and then just do what you like for the rest of the day.
Nice. Do you have a specific place that you like to write?
Not particularly. I actually do most of my writing on my phone. So it just kind of happens to be wherever I'm at. I don't do my editing on my phone. It's way too much work to kind of go back. But when it's just stream of consciousness and you're just putting the pages down for the first time, writing on the phone is actually really easy for me.
Well, I couldn't imagine writing on my phone. I can barely put notes on my phone. Big thumbs. I can't help it. So one question I also like to ask for all the authors Is there something, and of course, obviously you had your dad in your back pocket, but was there something that somebody told you early on that helped you, or something that you wished somebody had told you that you would tell another author?
For me, I didn't realize the distinction between popular writing and literature. And so I initially went to school to learn to write. And any college, they're going to teach you how to write literature, which is great if you want to be appreciated in 100 years. But I'd prefer to be appreciated a little bit more, promptly than that. And so I realized after about 2 years of college that they weren't really teaching me the lessons I needed to learn. You needed to go to learn from people that are kind of what you want to be like. And for me, Brandon Sanderson was like a perfect example of that because he was like a super prolific fantasy writer. I mean, everyone knows who he is if they're in the genre at all. But B, he also teaches tons of online courses and podcasts and just is really interested in teaching other people how to write. And having both those qualities in one made him like a perfect example to try to kind of follow and learn the practicalities of writing as opposed to the high-minded, more effervescent level of writing.
Yeah, I think his last Kickstarter did pretty well too, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think he's doing okay for himself, all things considered.
No complaints there. All right. So getting into the book, I did have a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
Was this always going to be, for lack of a better term, a buddy cop type series, or did you have either Grimsby or the Huntsman in mind first and then realized you needed somebody else to play off them?
It was pretty much always going to be a kind of a twist on buddy cop. It's a little bit more of a generational gap than traditional buddy cops tend to be. There's sort of like the mentor-mentee relationship that's played up a little bit more than a regular buddy cop, where they tend to be a little bit more on par with each other in terms of authority and experience. Or at least like there's like half a generation between them as opposed to like, two generations between them, that sort of deal. And so I always intended it to be in that buddy cop kind of vein, but I wanted to take a twist on it and have just the two very, very different characters that are differently focused in what they are good at. And also they have different moral stances on the world that kind of comes into clash and conflict often. Because I really thought, I made the mistake when I was first writing, I always wrote characters that were very individual, that were very on their own and solo. And I grew up as an only child, so it was just kind of a natural thing for me. But it's boring as hell to have a character by themselves most of the time, like because you're just looking in their head, and it takes a very skillful writer to make that an enjoyable experience. But a character that is always in the presence of at least one other person, especially a person that the audience hopefully has some sort of attachment to, and having both characters come into conflict with some consistency, and the audience is kind of themselves torn between the two, I think that's a really interesting dynamic that causes both the characters to question things and the audience to question things, and just kind of makes the story more tense and enjoyable.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was just kind of curious about that. The other question I was going to ask you before we get too much into the book, did you ever consider something outside of urban fantasy, or was that just kind of in your blood?
Sure, yeah. I did consider some other things. I have three or four big story worlds concepts that were kind of floating around. And honestly, I was equally excited to write any of them. But with the namesake, I felt like there's a lot of people that'll pick up the book just because it says Butcher on it. And I thought that it would be better to have, something that I knew that would appeal to those people initially as like a starting point for my career. And so I decided to go with the urban fantasy almost, as from a practical standpoint. I mean, it was still a story I was excited to write, but, when it was six of one, half dozen of the other, I decided to go with the one that I felt like, would hit the market a little bit better.
Gotcha. Yeah, and let me just say to anybody who's out there who hasn't picked up James J. Butcher before, if you think you're getting the Dresden Files, you're not. I mean, you've got yes, it's urban fantasy. Yes, there's a magic system. Yes, it's set in the real world. Yes, they're pseudo-detective type characters. But that's about where it goes. Like I said, you've got the Huntsman and Grimsby. Grimsby is about as opposite of as Dresden as you can get. Everybody in your world knows about magic. Nobody's hiding it from you. There's, like I said, even in the first book, I kept thinking to myself, I was like, even your humor is different. I do feel like in the second or third book, I kind of started to see where maybe the humor is a little bit the same, but because your story is so different, it comes across completely different.
Sure.
Other than the occasional self-deprecation. You both have that a little bit.
Yeah, that one runs in the blood for sure.
But yeah, like I said, if you like Dresden Files, yes, there's a chance you're going to like the Unorthodox Chronicles, but don't think you're getting a derivative of it or anything like that. Unorthodox Chronicles completely stands on its own, and it's a completely different vibe than you would get from your dad. So, but that's just because we brought up the connection. Otherwise, we're going to try to stay on you.
Sure. A
couple of things I did want to bring up. Grimshaw Griswold Grimsby.
Yeah.
What made you do that to that poor man?
Well, early on when I was figuring out the characters, figuring out the their personalities and so on, I knew that the more badass the character, the less badass their name could be. But that also meant the inverse had to be true. The less badass they were, the more badass their name could be. And that's where Grimsby's name started to develop. I actually heard the phrase Grimsby. I was listening to a podcast. I think it was Hardcore Histories. And it's just it was talking about World War One, and it was talking about how young men from England, in order to kind of incentivize them to draft up for the war, they would let people draft in a group. Your whole friend group could draft, and they'd be like a squad together in the war. And one of the groups that was drafted was from a place called Grimsby, and that's he just kind of mentioned that offhand, and that name stuck with me, and I really liked it. And I've always liked the G words, like grim, like that like the grim fairy tales, things like that. Like that, those words kind of stuck with me. And all it took was one more name to have that alliteration. So I was like, I'm sure I could figure out something. So I went with Griswold. And so I just gave him three names that were really cool, and then have him show up wearing a tutu in his first scene in the book. And just to kind of give people an idea that he does not take himself particularly seriously. And then by inverse, I have, you know, the dour huntsman that's been hunting monsters his whole life and specialized in dealing with horrible things. And his name's Leslie Mayflower. And it's the least badass name that I could imagine and I could come up with. And but at the same time, like I tried to portray him as though he takes himself very seriously. And the name Mayflower is well regarded. And it's something that, without the context, doesn't have much weight to it. But with the context, I think it makes the character feel more realistic and believable.
Yeah, he definitely feels like the type of character that does not let you call him Leslie.
Yes, exactly.
So one question I had, and it's not going to be super spoilish because I'm going to say it vaguely. You're okay. Going to know what I'm talking about. The Rain storyline that we get to in book three. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you had in your mind at book one, or is that something that just came up later? Like, I could do this to this character.
The overarching problem that leads to what happens to Rain is something that has been basically in the work since the beginning. Now, the specifics of what I wanted to do with it kind of developed as I got further into the story. Like, The concept of the asylum was something that I hadn't initially come up with. That was something I came up with in book two. And then I kind of start leveraging more and to book two and three. And so there are elements of it that have developed over time, but the core thread of there's something else about that character that's been part of her inception.
Gotcha. Because, I mean, I know for on the other hand, like, for instance, Black Skull, you can obviously see that runs. That was in there from the start, the whole right. Black Skull area. Where, again, I'm trying to avoid spoilers on I don't want to talk too much about book three. You definitely leave the end of this book open-ended. I won't say the name of the character, but you use the name of a character in such a way that we're not sure if it's the person we think it is or not. Mm-hmm. How far, again, I know authors, you're always like writing a year ahead of where the book comes out. How far are you into the next book? And I mean, do you have that all pictured in your head when you get to the end of three? Is four already in your brain?
Yeah, about halfway through book three, pieces of book four start coming to me. like little things that I want to include, little things that I didn't have space or time for in the current book that I just think are cool. And I just start taking separate notes of those. I don't usually start writing the book four until book three's at least the rough draft is done, and it's mostly just the editing that's left. Right now I'm working on book four and about halfway through it. And a lot of the concepts that I've worked through in this book are ones that I thought up during book three, but also ones that I set up during books one and two. I did a fair amount of legwork at the beginning of the story to try to create some little plot elements that seem throwaway that I can start pulling on later. It's always fun to kind of go back and pull on those threads and readers that, you know, remember are like, oh, this actually meant something, you know, two or three books later. And that's a really fun feeling to kind of inspire in people.
Gotcha. And I do have to say there's one character, you know, like He-Man, I hated Orko. Thundercats, I hated Snarf. Oh. For whatever reason, I love Wudge.
Excellent. Good to hear it.
I don't know what prompted that character for you.
Honestly, one of the big, very, very early in, concept phases of my writing is I just kind of scroll through Pinterest and I just look up stuff that's in just cool pieces of art that I'm like, if this was in my world, what would it look like? How would it be there? And I remember Wudge was a character that it basically developed initially from, there's just a picture of a pouting goblin sitting on somebody's like doorstep. Or maybe it was a windowsill. I forget exactly what. It just really struck me that particular image and character. I'm like, how can I make this into something that is enjoyable for readers and an absolute pain in the ass for everyone else in the story? And that's kind of where Wudge began his existence. And as I've kind of developed, because that character caught on with people way more than I anticipated it. I did not really intend he was going to be kind of a character that showed up once in a while, but he wasn't going to be in every book until I got like the feedback that I did from people about that character and how much they liked him. So I'm like, I could start including him more because he's fun. He's really fun to write. He's fun to include. It's really easy from the structural plot perspective. Like, oh, you know, when you're writing, it's like, man, I need something to go wrong here. Oh, there's Wudge. Wudge can make something go wrong. No problem. And that's totally in character for him. And it caused me to start developing like his backstory more, which has also impacted the greater overarching story of the world as well, which is actually something that I didn't anticipate either. My very first signing, one of the first like two or three people in line, it was in Phoenix, Arizona, like Phoenix Fan Fusion. I got my first fan art, and it was a teenage girl that had hand drawn a picture of Wudge and photocopied it and gave me a copy, and like I've got it on my fridge right now, and it's like, okay,
nice.
I need more Wudge for this reason alone. You know, if it inspires people like that, then sure, I'll include more of them.
I feel like Wudge is like your own personal Tasselhoff Burfoot. He's like, but why is everybody always upset about everything? It's like, well, you people are stupid. What's maybe kind of a hint of Mitzelplick.
Yeah, he's kind of beyond it all. You know, he makes you feel silly for worrying about things that seem important.
Yeah, I feel like he's really a good counter to him. Because, man, obviously you've got Grimsby. He's afraid of pretty much everything.
Yeah.
The Huntsman admits that it's smart to be afraid, but you just have to deal with it. And Wudge is just like, what's there to be afraid of?
Yeah.
Because he always gets out of everything. I think that helps. You know, if you're that person that gets away with everything.
Exactly. You've never really learned that hard lesson.
He didn't have quite as fun a time in book three. That's all I'm going to tell people. No spoilers. But yeah, book three, Wudge gets a little bit of the fear of mortality put in him. Let's put it that way. Oh, my goodness. So there are so many characters in this book, too. This one, I think, is the most where you wove so many stories. And I think, I can't remember how many, I don't have book one in front of me, but I feel like each book's gotten a little longer too.
Yeah, they have.
One's almost 500 pages, but it didn't feel like it. It was like, I finished this book in 4 days.
Oh, excellent.
So, it's a 480 page book in 4 days. I mean, yeah, I know there's some people out there who can do better than that. But for me, I got a full-time job. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
I just blew right through it. And especially once I started getting towards the end, it just like, what's happening next? I got to keep going. Man. I do have to say, and this is the last time I'm going to bring up your dad, you and your dad both hate your protagonist. That's what I've decided. The stuff you put these people through. I find that anybody who can write a protagonist in such a way and write the story that even you know, though you know he's the protagonist, you're still thinking, how the heck is he going to get out of this one, is just excellent writing.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, like, to get, you know, into the technical side of things for just a moment, have you seen the science experiment where they have somebody and they put a fake wall in front of their arm and they put a false arm in front of them? And then they stimulate both the false arm and their real arm, which they can't see anymore, with like a feather or something, and they to kind of make them associate the false arm with themselves. And then they pull out a hammer and slam it on the false arm, and people freak out. That's sort of the equivalent of what we do in writing with our characters, where it's like you have this primary character. They're the ones you spend the most time with. They're the ones that you feel the most emotional empathy with. And then you torture that person. And vicariously, by doing so, the reader feels a more like a stark set of emotions than they would if it was like a more distant character, or if the torture wasn't quite so grim, or if they weren't so close to that character. And it's like the writer's equivalent of that in my mind is kind of how I picture it.
And I love the elsewhere, too, that you've got this whole, I don't know what you even want to call it, but you've got this area that you can go into when you need things to get, like, even worse. You've got this built-in place. It's like, this doesn't have to be Boston. You've got this place that they can go, and it's just like everything, all the laws, all the rules are just off the table. And if you can survive, good luck.
Yeah, and it's so funny because the origin of the Elsewhere was actually because I had such a strong flaw as an early writer where I really liked to describe things. I really liked to wax poetic about stuff that had no relevance or import, and it made my books obscenely long when they didn't need to be. And so especially in an urban setting where people are more familiar with the environment, there's not as much things to describe. I created the Elsewhere as a way that I could have my cake and eat it too, where I could send Grimsby off to some place that's weird, and I could describe all the cool stuff that makes no sense that's happening. And it makes everything worse for him because he's there. And then he can go back to the real world and we can keep the pace moving, you know. But the Elsewhere itself, it was just it was like me getting a little fix of that description addiction that I had in my early stages of writing. But it's developed into something, you know, obviously that's considerably more impactful than I anticipated it being.
And did you know when you started out the Elsewhere 2, and anybody who's even read book one is going to know this, once you go into the Elsewhere, time is different, but it's different with, again, certain rules. Like, I think it was if you stay in there 7 minutes, 7 hours have passed. But if you stay in there 7 hours, like 7 weeks have passed, or I didn't write that down. I apologize.
Yeah, no worries. It is a little confusing, and it's meant to be a little confusing. It's mostly a means of helping me deal with time dilation problems in the actual story. Yeah. When you feel like too much stuff is happening in too small of a span, it doesn't feel realistic. So having the Elsewhere is a way of making a lot of things happen in a short time or a short amount of things happen in a long time is part of why I added that time dilation factor. But essentially, it's kind of like a bell curve where the earlier you're in there, the time gets distorted longer. So if you're in there under 7 minutes, 7 seconds will have passed in the real world. If you're in there over 7 minutes, up to 7 hours, 7 minutes past the real world. So you can get 7 extra hours of time if you spend in the Elsewhere. When you come back, only 7 minutes have passed. But as soon as you go over seven hours, it's 7 days have passed in the real world. So suddenly you lose time past that benchmark. Mm-hmm. So there's that hard benchmark where if you don't get out by the time, you know, the clock strikes 13, which the clocks all go to 13 in the Elsewhere, suddenly the window you thought you were returning to the real world has shifted drastically. So that could make a major impact on the story depending on when it happens.
Yeah, I think that helps add some tension to it as well too, because obviously anybody's done like a puzzle game, if you have all day long to fix the puzzle, you're probably going to get the puzzle done. But as soon as you've got that time constraint on it, mm-hmm. there's pressure, and all of a sudden your brain sometimes just wants to lock up. And you've got this feeling going into it. It's like, you know, that if I don't get out of here by that final bell, things are going to go a whole lot worse for me.
Yeah.
which really, really obviously, you know, this came into play at the end of Cold Iron Task. Mm-hmm. That time limit was very pressing.
Absolutely. That was a fun scene to write too, because of that time pressure. It would have been very different if Grisby had all day to figure out the problem.
Yeah. And I don't feel like this one's going to be spoilerish. Obviously we have the Huntsman at the beginning. When did you decide that the Huntsman was going to be a Huntsman and not necessarily the Huntsman?
That was always a thing.
Okay.
The Huntsman as a group were one of the few things that was actually good. They were the only ones good at keeping secrets in this setting. You know, you look at something like Supernatural, where it's like everything's a secret. All the monsters are secret. Nobody knows anything exists. In this world, everyone knows it exists, and they don't want to think about it. And then the Huntsmen are able to actually keep the secret that they exist because they don't want the monsters to know they exist either. It's less about the people knowing and more about the monsters knowing, because they deal with the monsters. And if the more the monsters know about them, the less, you know, likely they are to be able to deal with the problem. And frankly, the less the monsters know, the scarier the Huntsmen are.
Gotcha. See, I just always, and maybe this was just my feeling going into it, especially for with Leslie, I felt like the Huntsman was kind of, you know, the, you know, 500-pound gorilla on the block, and even the monsters were scared of him.
Right, right.
So, but yeah, it's like the rest of the Huntsman that came as a little bit of a surprise to me. But I can definitely see, I mean, you handled it well. You could see how it wrote into the story. But I was just, like I said, I was curious about, you know, if it's always interesting to me when a story goes off on its own and it's taking you somewhere, and when a story is something that you'd always had planned in the first place.
Sure, sure. Yeah, there's definitely spontaneous things that have developed since I, you know, started writing this series. And that's part of the fun for me, too, is that I, you know, I get a quarter of the way through the book and I think of a really cool idea. And I'm like, oh, crap, now I got to go back, you know, and make it happen.
That's what the beta readers are for, right?
No, yeah.
Side question. Sure. We already talked about the fact that, you know, book four is already on your mind. And I'm assuming you've already started it.
Yeah.
When do you see yourself maybe looking at some of those other worlds or stories that you've thought of and you want to maybe dip your toe into?
That's a good question. It's something that I've been giving some consideration. I want to start expanding my writing a little bit and dipping into other fields and other stories. For instance, I've started doing a consulting position to help write the story for a video game. I have my yearly obligation to put out a Grimsby book, which I want to keep up. And then between those, I also kind of want to start working on new stories in a new setting. But one of the nice things about urban fantasy is it kind of comes really easy. There's a lot of elements about urban fantasy that the readers are left to assume, just like the day-to-day, what the world looks like, things like that, that mean that I can just skip through the vegetables and get straight to the meat and potatoes. And when it comes to like more high fantasy settings, which are both the other stories I'm considering, they're considerably more legwork to kind of get your feet under you, get the reader grounded in the setting, to get them to feel like they can immerse themselves. And it's just, at the end of the day, it's more words on the page. And every word on the page is more work for me on my end. And it's more work for, you know, the editors on the editor's end. It takes longer to do. And so, to, you know, to write an epic fantasy, I would expect it to probably take about twice as much effort to write as writing like an urban fantasy. The other setting I want to write in is like a post-apocalyptic Western. You know, that's an even smaller genre than an epic fantasy. And like getting that established would be very difficult. And so I'm starting to kind of settle into the pace of writing a book a year. I've had Cold Iron Task ended up being later than I wanted it to be. Because you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of story threads involved, and this is the trimmed down version. It was about 30,000 words longer than it is now. And the editing of this particular book took a good while to kind of trim down the stuff that was unnecessary. And I got to kind of save that for later for another book. But I'm starting to feel like I can get comfortable writing these books and putting them out on a consistent basis. But I also kind of want to be pushing my skill set as well with them and kind of exploring the world more and making each book feel like it's more skillfully done than the last. And so it's just a lot of my plate to deal with, in addition to thinking about a new book and a new story and a new setting, because so much of the time spent writing is spent thinking about writing. and there's only so much headspace going on up here. You know, my handful of brain cells have their work cut out as it is. So I do want to work on some new stuff, but I'm starting to make some lifestyle adjustments to kind of hopefully get more work done and maybe be able to start juggling a couple of projects simultaneously.
Nice. I am interested to see what else you've got coming down the pipe. I do have to say, I have to agree with you, though, because at least on Urban Fantasy, a lot of the world building's already done for you. I mean, Boston already exists.
Right.
So you're kind of covered there. The other thing that I liked about yours, everybody, of course, every author has their own magic system. I feel like yours touches on a bit of both. It's got, for the rituals, for instance, you've got very much what might be considered like the Dragonlance type of thing, where there's, you know, spell components and things and words that need to be said and all this good stuff. But for the actual witches, I feel it touches much more into that thing where it's all about, you know, the willpower. It's, you know, shaping the magic with what you want it to do instead of learning a specific spell and memorizing a certain incantation. So what made you decide to split those up and make the rituals in such a way that even a non-magic user could use the rituals?
Well, the practical element that made me want to split it up was if the story's more interesting, if you know, you have these rituals that are powerful or dangerous, and if only witches can do them, and witches are such a small percentage of the population, the mystery of who did it is a lot more narrow. But if anyone could have done it, the mystery is much more broad. So there's that practical element of letting the you know, average people or even monsters get access to these rituals and magical abilities that aren't necessarily, they don't feel the same as witches, but they still have a drastic impact that they can put onto the story. And then from like that, I knew that I wanted magic to not just be solely belonging to witches, at least not the ritual magic. But when it comes to the kind of just the stuff that you can snap your fingers and make happen, that's what makes witches different than everything else. And that's what kind of drives a lot of the story elements. The fact that witches are connected to the elsewhere and they can see into it without having to go into it. And that's where they draw their magic from. That has made them a very valuable tool for society, which is why witches are still around instead of having been witch-trialed out of existence. And then in order to kind of establish those two things I wanted to do, I just looked at, honestly, D&D and just took wizards and sorcerers. And it was like, okay, rituals and stuff, that's wizard stuff. Anybody that goes to school long enough can learn to do wizard stuff. And then sorcerer stuff, that you're just born with that. You know, you have it or you don't. There's not much to do about it elsewise. And so that I just kind of leveraged that into the story and tried to make it my own and make it feel more interesting for it.
Gotcha. And without going into any spoilers, I do love both the situation and the final spell that Grimsby has at the end of book three. Didn't see that coming. I thought he was going to finally pull off something else. And then
yeah,
he just pulled one out of the back pocket there that nobody was expecting. All right. So, man, I'm trying to avoid spoilers so bad now. I can't, like I said, so much of this book wrapped up so well that, you know, almost any questions I really have after this book are all about book four, which it is way too early to get into. I think as for the book, is there anything you wanted to talk about the book that we haven't discussed?
Book three.
It's coming out tomorrow. So, you know, are we telling people to make sure they come pick it up?
Well, honestly, it was really hard to write, but I'm proud that it came together the way it did. The initial draft of it, I was honestly really disappointed with, and I spent a good 6 months rewriting it, and I think it was well worth the effort, and I'm proud with the result I ended up with.
Gotcha. Perfect. All right, so I think that pretty much wraps that up for the book thing. I do have a few other questions I just always like to ask people, authors, I should say. And I've managed to close my reminder list here. What skill, hobby, or accomplishment do you wish more people knew about you outside of writing?
I wouldn't say I necessarily wish more people knew about it, but I do have other hobbies I pursue. You can kind of see in the background how much of a mess it is, because this is my work den. So I do my gaming on this side of the room, and then I do my... my hobby stuff on that side of the room, and I engage in a lot of miniature painting and 3D printing and stuff of that variety. I've been getting back into 40K for the first time in like 2 decades. I like started playing when I was 13, and then I just started picking it up again, and that's been a lot of fun. So that's mostly what I've been doing in my non-writing time.
Yeah, I think Henry Cavill is dragging a lot of people back into the 40K thing right now. And also, luckily for me, my messy side is in the foreground. You can't see it from here, so I'm not going to complain about that. What are you reading right now?
So I've been trying to get back into reading. For a long time, I haven't really been reading that much because the headspace I'm in when I write is the same headspace I'm in when I read, and nobody pays me to read. So I spend most of that time writing, but it is good for me to get re-immersed in other people's stories and see how they tell their stories and see if I can't find ways of making it or using their ideas and processes to help improve my own writing. And so I've been, mostly after the gym, I'll get on the treadmill and read for 15, 20 minutes or what have you afterwards. And, the book I've been reading lately is, Six Gun Tarot, by R.S. Belcher. It was recommended to me by a friend, when I was talking to her about wanting to write like my apocalyptic Western. And it's sort of like, it's like an urban fantasy if it was set in the Western, in old Western times, you know, in the old West. You know, there's this town in the middle of the desert, and everybody in the town has a secret, and there's like magic, and there's weird tech, and it's on the surface it looks like Six Gun Shooters and all that, but below it it's got more of the fantasy element that I've been looking for, and it's really, really beautifully written, and that's part of what keeps drawing me through the story is just like the command of language that Belcher has. But the story is very dense, and it's very amorphous, and it takes some conscious effort to kind of put it together, and it's quite heavy. So if you're into that kind of story, I would highly recommend it.
I can't remember if there's a genre, you know, like there's steampunk and cyberpunk and all that. There's one that's called Flintlock something. I can't remember what it's called.
Oh, really?
But yeah, it's a whole thing about, you know, Flintlock. So it's old-fashioned guns and magic.
Okay. Which,
I mean, you're almost, I mean, you basically get Grimsby and the Huntsman right there. I mean, that's pretty close. But
fair enough.
But yeah, that's it's kind of reminding me of that whole genre, which is one I want to get into. Like, I know, was it Powder Mage, I think?
That sounds familiar.
I don't want to say the author because I'm second-guessing myself, and I don't want to say the wrong person. But
have that recorded for all time.
Exactly. I mean, I make enough mess ups as it is. Was there any question that you expected to be asked, or just something that you wanted to talk about that we didn't touch upon?
Not necessarily. I mean, I just want to say that I'm working on book four now, and I'm really enjoying the direction book four is going. It is something that I planned, anticipated about halfway through book three that this is the direction the story was going, but around books one and two, I hadn't fully had that idea. And so this book has a little bit more expansion on Wudge and his background. And we talked about that earlier, how that wasn't something I had fully anticipated going in the direction of. But it's also got some new elements and new parts of the setting that the people haven't seen before necessarily, but have been hinted at. So I'm excited to kind of explore that more and show people some of the higher fantasy elements of the unorthodox setting.
Gotcha. And one thing I will mention, one more thing about the book, especially in book three, one of the things, and I'm not blowing smoke because you may never talk to me after this and you've already been on the channel. So, you know, but one of the things I really enjoyed about your writing is I feel like when you have a situation like in book three where there's multiple storylines at the same time, I feel like you weave them together better than some authors do. I've seen some authors where they carry multiple storylines and it's almost kind of jarring as you go back and forth.
Yeah.
But yours, I mean, you feel almost like it's weaving back together towards the end. And I can even see at the end of book three, you've got a lot of storylines that are probably still going to have to be brought up in book four. You've got the Wudge thing going on. You've got the Huntsman thing going on. You've got the Rain thing going on. You've got Black Skull still going on.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just, I mean, I can't wait to see book four. I know I'm going to have to wait to see book four, but I can't wait to see book four. I feel lucky enough that they were kind enough to send me book three early, so I even get to see that one early. But yeah, I'm totally looking forward to what's coming out. Yes, I would certainly enjoy seeing what else you have to write, but I'm also down for some more Grimsby and Huntsman, as long as you're going to keep putting them out there.
That's the plan.
And then the last question I ask every author, I'm not an Amazon hater per se, but I do love my local independent bookstores. Sure. So shout out to a brick and mortar store of your choice.
I've got a place that's on Colfax here in Denver. It's called it's one of the Tattered Covers. And I really enjoy that store in particular because it's actually built inside of like a theater, what used to be a theater. And so the layout of that particular building is very unique from every other bookstore I've been to. It's like this, almost like a coliseum as you're going down into the middle, and there's like this reading nook at the bottom. It's really, really cool. If you haven't been there and you live in the Denver area, you should check it out.
Yeah, I don't know if I've been to that one, but yeah, any book lover who's been through Denver has stopped at a Tattered Cover, at least one of them. I know there's a few. And if nothing else, I got one in the airport, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think that's accurate.
So, all right. And then, crud, I just thought of something. Oh, the other thing I was going to ask you, this is completely off topic. I will not hold you to this, but I am curious. Any plans on going to Worldcon?
I don't have plans yet, but I'm still getting my kind of this year's schedule situated, especially towards the later end of the year. So I'll have to look into Worldcon and see if it fits in that schedule.
Perfect. Well, if you do, this is going to be my very first con. I'm going to that. I know Martin Wells is going to be there. Sean McGuire is going to be there. Ton of authors I know are going to be there. And I'm like, I can't pass this up. I've been putting it off for way too many years. I'm finally going to hit myself a con, especially since Worldcon is relatively close. I'm stuck in Omaha for anybody who doesn't know. So it's not, not crazy. It's not like Glasgow like last year.
Sure.
So. All right. Well, I think that is probably going to wrap it up. Like I said, this drops tomorrow, guys. If you haven't checked out the Unorthodox Chronicles yet, definitely pick it up. If you've started the Unorthodox Chronicles, book three is just, a few hours away from being able to be in your hands. Definitely give that a read. And if, for instance, one other question, it's related to your other question.
Sure.
Is the Colfax Tattered Cover someplace that if somebody really, really wanted a signed copy, would that be a place they might reach out to see if you could sign something for them?
Potentially so. I did a signing at, I think it was that location last year for Long Past Dues. So if there's enough interest, then I'm sure that some sort of signing out there can be arranged for book three as well.
Okay, perfect. So, all right. I want to thank you for hopping on. Again, I want to thank Berkeley Publicity, part of Penguin Random House, for helping me put this together, both the book and being able to get a hold of you and talk to you about this. That is probably going to wrap it up. Appreciate everybody who stopped in. We didn't get any questions, but we did get a few comments in there. I saw author Dennis Myers popped his head in for a little bit to check you out. So. I am going to wrap it up now, and I will, if you got nothing else going on Thursday, Jen Lyons is going to be hopping on. She's got a sci-fi book coming out. Between now and then, go pick up Cold Iron Tash. You're not going to regret it. Thanks, James.
Yeah.